Please give a warm Montreal welcome to Mr. Mario Vargas Llosa.
Mesdames, Messieurs, chers amis, merci beaucoup pour cette réception si chaleureuse. Je voudrais remercier Michel Kelly-Gagnon pour sa présentation. Je me sens maintenant très confus de parler après une présentation pareille. I am afraid my speech will be an anticlimax after this wonderful speech. The title of my speech is An Intellectual Journey from Marxism to Liberalism. This, of course, is a very long story, and I shall try to reduce it to very modest proportions, because otherwise that would become a very long lecture. I would start saying that in the 50s, when I was 14, 15, 16 years old, it was very difficult for a Peruvian, for a Latin American, who had discovered social problems that Latin American countries were suffering military dictatorships, that the social problems were really enormous because the enormous social and economic differences, that in our countries not justice but injustice prevail because the exploitation of the poor by the very small group of privileged people was brutal, that prejudices, racism were everywhere you look at. So it was very difficult in an environment like that, when you are young and when you are rebellious and when you want to change everything, not be pushed towards radical, to extremism, to something that seemed to be the antipodes of this situation. And that was, of course, Marxism, communism, socialism. How I became a communist. I think it was very important for me, a book that I was a voracious reader since I learned how to read. That was when I was 5 years old. And I was, my life changed completely. I discovered a kind of magical artifact that enriched the life in a fantastic way. So I was, as I said, a voracious reader. And when I was in my last years at the school, I read a book by a German communist, former communist, because finally he break with the communists, Jean Valtin, La Noche Quedó Atrás. I don't know which is the English title of his book. It was his autobiography. I read it with an enormous enthusiasm. He was a German communist that lived, of course, an underground during the 30s, during the Nazi period. And of course, his life was so adventurous. And I became completely infatuated with the kind of person that he was at least in the testimony that he gave in his book. A man totally committed with universal equality, solidarity with the victims of a brutal, racist regime, fighting underground, investing heroism, great courage, moral conviction in the fight for a better society, for a better country, for a better world. Peru was living a dictatorship at the time. In 1948, General Odría, a general, had led a military coup, and the president, the democratic president that we had for 3 years, Bustamante Rivero, had been evicted and expelled from the country. This has produced in my family a big frustration and indignation, because my family, my maternal family, was very democratic, and also the president defeated and expelled was a relative of us. So the democratic environment in which I spent my adolescence was very propitious to what I became. So I finished the school. I belonged to a middle-class family, and my family wanted very much for me to enter to the Catholic University, which was at that time the university in which middle-class boys went. But I decided not to go to the Catholic University, but to San Marcos. San Marcos was the national university, the popular university, and I wanted to be there because the Cholos, half-bred Peruvians, the Indians were there, not in the Catholic University, and also because the tradition of anti-conformism of this university, which has been always mobilized against dictators, and which was very, very radical in its political attitudes. And I wanted to enter San Marcos because I wanted to become a communist. And I was convinced that probably it was the way to reach this invisible communist party that I was sure that existed, but nobody saw it. Well, I entered San Marcos, and the last year, 1952, it was a strike against the government in San Marcos, and the university had been decimated by repression. Many teachers, many students were or in prison or in exile, and the two leftist parties that survived more or less, of course, worked underground, the Apristas, which was the largest leftist party in Peru, and the Communists, which was very, very small. Well, I became a member of this party, which was called El Grupo Cahuide, Cahuide for an Inca hero fought against the Spaniards. And we were really very few, but very Stalinistic. Really very dogmatic and sectarian. And we study Marxism in underground, of course, circles. We read Lenin, we read Marx. We read and we learned practically by heart a French communist philosopher, author of a book, Lecciones Preliminares de Filosofía. I have forgotten his name. And everything was so clear. What was black, what was white, the right and the wrong. But in spite of my commitment to Grupo Cahuide and Marxist ideas that I learned in this romantic underground way, I think I had something that permit me to remain a bit critical of what was the Marxist dogma which impregnated the Peruvian communists in those years. And it was my reading of the French thinkers and philosophers. Those were the years of existentialism, Sartre, Camus, Merleau-Ponty, had a great influence all over Latin America, and they marked very much the kind of commitment of artists, writers, intellectuals to radical causes. Sartre was never an orthodox Marxist. He was very near Marxism. He said that he accepted historical materialism, but he rejected philosophical materialism. He considered that it was mechanicist, and he was very partially critical of communism. And I was a great follower of Sartre. I read everything, even the books that I didn't understand. I read it since the beginning until the end. And we had, because of my enthusiasm with Sartre, with Camus, with Merleau-Ponty, ferocious discussions with my comrades in the circles. And I remember one day in which we were discussing with one of my comrades about Jeet. Jeet was hated by communists all over the world because he has written this book against the Soviet Union after a visit. And I was enthusiastic because I had enjoyed very much Le Nourriture Terrestre, très beau. And I remember very well how suddenly a comrade looked at me very seriously, and he said to me, "Mario, you are subhuman." My God, I am some subhuman because I like Jeets, you know. So I couldn't stay much more in the communists. They were really extremely dogmatic, and I felt imprisoned in something that I couldn't share 100%. So I break with the Grupo Cahuide, but I remain following Sartre ideas mostly, Merleau-Ponty ideas, very, very leftist. And then suddenly, in 1960, the Cuban Revolution defeated Batista, and the Barbudos entered La Habana. You can't imagine the effect that the Cuban Revolution had all over Latin America, particularly among young people. We were injected with a kind of enthusiasm for many, many Latin Americans like myself who felt that they were very leftist but couldn't be communists because the dogmaticism, because the very limited kind of vision that the communists have. The idea that something that was very radical, a radical transformation of society, but without the kind of mental obtuseness of the communists, could be possible, was something that gave us the idea, an idea that rapidly became a myth, that the Cuban Revolution was something absolutely new, not only in the American, in the Latin American world, but also in the radical and socialist world. We really believed what Fidel Castro was saying, what Che Guevara was saying at the beginning of the revolution, that Cuba, the revolutionary Cuba, represented socialism with freedom. Well, in 1962, as you know, there was this missile crisis in November, which was a very serious event. At that time, I was working as a journalist in France, in the French radio television, and I had been sent to Mexico to cover a very important French exhibition there, and then sent me to Cuba, when the big problem started with Khrushchev, Kennedy, and Fidel Castro. And that was the first time I went to Cuba. It was very moving. The whole island was mobilized against this American invasion that seemed to be imminent, you know. And there was such atmosphere, you know, that remember me what George Orwell said in his book about Catalonia, about the impression that he had when he arrived as a volunteer for fighting for the Republic to Barcelona. What he saw was solidarity, equality, generosity, a world that was moved by principles, by very altruistic kind of feelings. And that was the impression that I had from the Cuba in this November of 1962. Of course, that was very superficial. Huh? There were already serious problems, but they were completely disfigured or minimized because the major problem that was the possibility of Cuba to be invaded by the United States. And I met some people. I had already published, so I was a more or less well-known writer. And I was invited then to become member of an international committee for the Casa de las Americas, which was a cultural institution of the revolution. And so because I was member of this committee during the 60s, I went to Cuba five or six times. We had meetings, we had discussions, and in 1962 and 1963 and 1964 was a very well militant in favor of the Cuban Revolution. I knew that there were problems, but my impression was that there were minor problems and that the essential altruistic goals of the revolution were still there. But all this started to change in 1966. Maybe some of you remember what was the creation of the UMAPS, Unidades Movilizables de Apoyo a la Producción, unities to support production. That was a fantastic euphemism. Actually, the UMAPS were concentration camps in which dissidents, common criminals, and gays, male and female gays, were put together. And this produced in Cuba terrible dramas. There were suicides of young people. It was the first serious moral and political problem that I had with the revolution. I had met many in my visits to Cuba. I had met many writers, and I knew a young group of writers, male and female, which had organized El Puente. It was called The Bridge, El Puente, an association in which there were painters, poets, novelists, playwrights, very young people. And all of them were real revolutionaries, totally identified with the revolution. But many of them were gays. And so they were sent to these concentration camps. There were suicides among themselves. Well, it was very unjust, unfair, stupid, you know. And these persecutions, this brutal persecution of homosexuals, it was something that I couldn't understand. So I wrote a letter to Fidel Castro. I hadn't met Fidel Castro. But I wrote a letter to say, a very personal letter saying, well, I am totally confused. I don't understand how Cuba, the island of freedom, of justice, can produce something so unfair, brutal. And I was invited to go to Cuba with a group of writers that had also sent letters saying that they were confused, like myself, because what happened, what was this UMAPS? And this is the only time that I had a conversation. Well, it was impossible to have a conversation with Fidel Castro, but that I was with him for 12 hours, from 8 at the evening until 8 in the morning. We were 10, 12 writers, more or less, and it was practically impossible to talk, you know, because when you manage to put a phrase, you were immediately stopped by this force of nature, you know, who during 12 hours spoke practically with a dynamism, with such contagious enthusiasm, you know. But, well, we managed to say, well, what about these UMAPS? You know, it's something that we don't understand. He said, well, there are problems. You know, the peasants are so terrified that their sons, their daughters can be abused, you know, by the enfermitos. The homosexuals were called the enfermitos by the revolution, no? The sick people, no? And he talked about Che Guevara. Che Guevara had disappeared. Nobody knew where he was. You know, he sent ideas about possible places in which Che Guevara could be starting a new revolution. And it was very impressive to see Fidel Castro, to see this myth, you know. He has already a myth all over the world. But I was not convinced. I was impressed, but I was not convinced by what he said. And since then, I started to wonder if I had not been fooled by my own enthusiasm and by my own wishes that socialism with freedom as different kind of socialism materialize in Latin America. It started this process in which I was taking distance from socialism, from my enthusiasm with Cuba. There were many episodes which were very important for me. In Europe, those were the years in which dissidents from the Soviet Union, from Polonia, from Hungary, from Czechoslovakia, started to come to the Western world, and testimonies about the Gulag, about a very different, you know, phase of communism. I was very confused for several years until 1966, in which I went to the Soviet Union for the first time. I had just moved from, it was 67, 66. I had just moved from Paris to London, and I was invited to the Soviet Union to some commemoration of Pushkin. And I spent 2 weeks there. And this was the most terrible political disappointment that I have had in my life. I already knew that there were many, many things that went wrong in the Soviet Union. But I had never expected to see a kind of country in which I knew it since the first days there. I couldn't live without becoming a dissident, without being sent to a concentration camp, or to choose exile. And I remember during those days in which I saw the kind of discrimination that existed among the nomenklatura, the powerful people with political power, and the common men and women. It was such a distance, you know. That was inexisted even in Latin America. If you could enter a restaurant, for example, because you had this privilege, because your job, you became so far away from what was the experience of these poor people that were hours queuing to enter a restaurant in which there was practically 10% of the things that you had in a restaurant in which you could pay with foreign money, you know? Well, everything I saw, everything I heard was so painful, you know? I remember a conversation with a man that the Writers Union had put me, very kind person. We went together from Moscow to Leningrad. And during the whole travel in the train, he was telling me about the marvelous Leningrad, you know, and how wonderful was the city, how cultural life was so rich, and how sad it was for him to be living in Moscow. And I was stupid enough to say to him, but why don't you move to Leningrad? To Leningrad? Why are you living in Moscow? And I remember the way he looked at me, as if I was a fool. What kind of question is that? And then I discovered that he couldn't move from Moscow because he had been given an apartment in Moscow. So he was attached to this apartment the rest of his life. And in this same journey to Leningrad, I discovered that if you were a Russian, you need a visa to go from Moscow to Leningrad. You couldn't move out of Moscow, or you couldn't move out of Leningrad, or you couldn't move out of any city without a visa. So each city was a kind of concentration camp too. I asked an interview with the director of the Young Guard publishing house that had published my first novel. And I had discovered just a few weeks before my invitation to Soviet Union that the Young Guard, the Russian publishing house that had published my novel, had cut almost 40 pages of my book. So finally I was received by the director of this publishing house. It was a young lady, beautiful, very discreet, with blue eyes. And I was so furious when I was received by her. I said to her, you have cut 40 pages of my novel. My novel was published in a fascist dictatorship, Franco Spain, you know? And they cut 8 phrases, 8. And you have cut 40 pages without asking my permission. She listened very quietly. She said, we respect your ideas, but you must understand the Russian reader cannot be vexed by things that you tell in your book. We are very prudent in Russia. We don't accept, so explicit descriptions of sexual relations. It's so offensive for the families, A young couple couldn't see each other at the eyes after reading things like that, And I couldn't believe what I heard, I said, but who knows this? How do you know this? And he told me, all my literary advisors are PhD from Moscow University. So after that, I decided that I was not a communist and that I didn't want Latin America to become communist, and that had been losing my time and my years reading all that I had been reading about Marxism. And I felt very alone and very naked. It's something that happened. Once I talked with a friend of mine who had been a priest, and then he abandoned the church, and we decided that we had experienced something very similar after he left the church and after I had left Marxism. We felt so like zombies, empty. So I started to read, and it was so important for me, so important to read in France, writers that I hadn't, I knew that they existed, but they were so repellent for me. One of them was Raymond Aron. To read Raymond Aron in those years was so important, surtout L'Opium des Intellectuels. Marxism, L'Opium des Intellectuels. Fantastic book. An extraordinary book. Extraordinary book. In which all the illusions of this Marxism theory were described with such knowledge and elegance, I would say neutrality, and at the same time, this book was a so lucid explanation of why writers, artists, intellectuals were so avidly attracted by Marxism, why they were so cynical about democracy, and had been destroying intellectually, theoretically, philosophically, the culture of freedom. Another writer that I discovered those years was Jean-François Revel. Jean-François Revel had started very young. He was a brilliant man, realmente a very brilliant man, a bit younger than the than the generation of Sartre. And he had written a very impressive book, Pourquoi le philosophe? And then, as Raymond Aron, he had been publishing books in defense of democracy, in defense of the liberal tradition, and fighting practically in total solitude, the orientation of the French literary and intellectual classes towards Marxism and towards radical socialism. I could mention many other people, but Raymond Aron and Jean-François Revel were extremely important and permit me to reivindicate the democratic idea, which in the past years I had despise. As I think the great majority of intellectuals of my generation, convinced that democracy was the mask of exploitation and that it was purely formal and that it was impossible that through democracy justice could be rooted in societies. And it was like that that I became a Democrat. Not a liberal yet, but a Democrat. Maybe a social Democrat, although Rebel was also very critical of social democracy. And then came the Affair Padilla. Maybe some of you remember what was the Affair Padilla. Padilla had been a very important poet in Cuba who had practically abandoned poetry in spite of poetry to be his real vocation to work for the revolution. He was convinced that there was no time for poetry but for action. And he became a very committed, you know, civil servant of the revolution. He was even for a while vice minister of exterior commerce. And so he was a really committed revolutionary. But in the late 60s, he started to criticize the cultural policy of the revolution. And he wrote an article that was published in a, I think, a university journal. And immediately, there was a brutal satanization of Alberto Padilla in all the official press of the island. And we were very good friends with Padilla, so I was surprised with what was happening with him. And the last time that I went to Cuba, I met Padilla, and he was completely transformed. He was terrified, and he knew that something would happen to him. And it was an atmosphere that was even worse than all that what I had found in my previous travels to Cuba. There was fear, there was panic among writers, poets, journalists. Everybody had the impression that something very, very serious was started to come anytime to Cuba. And effectively, when I returned to Europe a few weeks ago, Padilla was sent to prison and accused to be a CIA agent. With a group of friends who were more or less in my position towards Cuba, we wrote a manifest, an open letter to Fidel Castro protesting for the prison of Padilla and asking for an explanation and what was happening. And to our big surprise, Padilla came out for prison in a public act in which he made his self-criticism in a kind of repetition of the worst fake trials of the 30s, you know, in which very heroic communists accused themselves that being working with the Nazis and against the revolution. So that was something that produced a kind of earthquake, you know, all over Latin America. And particularly among intellectuals and writers. So we wrote another manifest, which was signed by many, many European, American writers who had been supporting the Cuban Revolution and creating a kind of division. Since then, of the revolution and the intellectual, an important part of the intellectual class. Sartre, Alberto Moravia signed this manifest. For me, it was very, very important because although I was attacked viciously by the left all over Latin America, I felt since then totally free. I recovered a kind of independence that I decided I wouldn't lose anymore for any cause. And since then, I have been doing, well, what some of you know, fighting very much in the domain of ideas in favor of democracy, trying to demystify this idea of socialism, of collectivism, of estatism as an instrument to create the real kind of freedom in a society. Something that is quite obvious in our days, but in the 70s was something that was very difficult to maintain without being accused of being also a CIA agent and be paid, you know, by the transnationals. But in those years also, I discovered liberalism. I discovered liberalism through books, as always in my life. Every important thing that has happened to me in my life has been through books. I read first Isaiah Berlin. I don't know how I discovered Isaiah Berlin. Isaiah Berlin, I think, is one of the most extraordinary essayists of our times. He was born in Lithuania during the Soviet Revolution. He was expelled to England. He became a very important philosopher. And to read Isaiah Berlin is really extraordinary because certain ideas, which are profoundly democratic, as tolerance, for example, is something that becomes so vivid. You understand what tolerance means. How tolerance means civilization, how tolerance means the only way in which we can coexist without killing each other for religious, for political reasons. What is fascinating with, he was a Democrat and he was a liberal, but most of his books, his essays, are not about democratic thinkers, liberal thinkers, are about the enemy. Fascist, communist. Probably the best book that has been written about Marx is written by Isaiah Berlin, trying to understand without mystifying, you know, what they said or what they thought. On the contrary, trying to understand that there were good intentions behind the ideas that they promoted and that produced monsters like Soviet Union, China Popular. I think I was really impregnated by essential ingredients of liberalism. The first of one, of course, is tolerance. Admit the possibility of being in the error and admit the possibility that the adversary may be right. This kind of openness, I think, is the essential virtue of liberalism. And that is the reason why liberalism is the roots of civilization, of this beautiful, marvelous thing that we call civilization. I think Isaiah Berlin is fantastic, you know. It's fantastic to understand how important is that ideas were submitted to the proof of reality and not the opposite. Ideas should prove that they are realistic to be acceptable and authentic. Otherwise, we must change. We cannot change reality. We cannot change human condition. But we can change ideas. And this is something that you learn reading Isaiah Berlin. And immediately after Isaiah Berlin, I discovered Karl Popper, who I think is the most important thinker in political terms in modern times. when I read the Open Society and its enemies in a state of trance, as I had read Joyce, or as I had read Ulysses of Joyce, or Les Misérables by Victor Hugo, I felt that I was understanding something that until then had been there, but in such a confusion, you know. And that repression, totalitarian systems, the idea that life could be controlled entirely by the power since the beginning until the death of people. That was the most ancient idea in history. Popper started with Greece, with Plato, saying it starts there. It was the most intelligent man of his time. And he created all the basic foundations for totalitarianism. So this is the longest, the oldest tradition in humanity. And civilization one day started to develop and started to put a kind of wall to this tradition. And it was like that civilization started. And civilization is basically the idea of coexisting in diversity. We should coexist in diversity. And this is the only way in which we can diminish the violence that is in all of us, in all the instincts, in all the passions that are inseparable of the human condition. I think The Open Society and Its Enemies is the most important book to understand what freedom means. What is the importance, the essential importance of freedom if we want to achieve any kind of progress in any level of existence? In the economy, of course. In politics, of course. In culture, of course. In religion, of course. We have to accept this coexistence in diversity. And when these ideas started to take roots in the Western world, the Western world changed dramatically, and life changed dramatically. And what has been, you know, the legacy, the most important legacy of the past, violence, abuses, crimes, started to regress. Well, I could speak for hours about this, but I'm going to stop here. But adding something which I think is quite important. What has happened to me? What has happened, I think, to many writers, artists, intellectuals of my generation, and not only in Latin America, but all over the world, is something that has been happening also to Latin America. If 20 years ago I would have to speak about Latin America, my speech would have been very pessimistic. I was very pessimistic at that time. Now, I am not. I think, as in my case, Latin America, from error to error, has been moving in the right direction. To understand this, I think it's very important to compare not Latin America with the ideal, because Latin America, of course, is very far away from the ideal, as any country in the world, but from what Latin America was 30, 40 years ago. What Latin America was 40 years ago? A continent of military governments, brutal, corrupt. Latin America was a region in which the most alive ideas were related to Marxism, to socialism, to revolution. Young idealists were Democrats? Not at all. They were revolutionaries. They didn't think that democracy was the framework in which you could fight successfully against economic poverty, social injustices. No, they thought that socialism was the right answer to these problems. And what happened now in Latin America? These ideas are completely obsolete. Even people who think that they are still socialists and estatists and collectivists are doing in their lives exactly the opposite. And this has been pushing Latin America towards the right direction. How many military dictatorships we have now in Latin America? None. We have a very brutal dictatorship, 53 years old, Cuba. But is Cuba still a model for the idealistic young Latin Americans? Not at all. I would say that there is no followers for the Cuban Revolution. You have very isolated cases, and in many cases, opportunistic cases that still defend the Cuban Revolution. But even the leftist parties in Latin America are taking distance because they know that this is a kind of model that produces horror instead of the magical attraction that Cuba had, a country that is still, you know, with the same nomenclatura, very old, a country that is a total failure, absolutely a total failure. Sad country in which it seems that the major goal for the majority of the population is not to fight, is to escape, is to escape. Even facing the sharks of the Caribbean Sea, and to enter to the United States. What a sad image of a country in which what people want is to escape, to abandon the country. Venezuela can be a model for someone in Latin America. Look what happened. Venezuela is so rich, that could have standards of living of the most rich people in the world. And look what happened in Venezuela. Inflation, hyperinflation now. The collapse of the economy in an incredible way. One of the richest countries in oil is producing now the third, only the third of what produced 20 years ago. All the nationalizations of enterprises has produced what? Collapse of these enterprises. And that is the reason why the opposition has been growing and growing and probably had won the last elections. But these elections were rigged, of course. But how can a country in this state to be still a model of the future for idealistic people? Oh, I think this is an anachronism, and this is something that is going to fade away, hopefully sooner than later. What we have on the contrary are countries like Chile, like Colombia, like Peru, like Brazil, like Mexico, which are moving forward because they have adopted political democracy, imperfect democracies, of course, but political democracy, and market economy. Modernization of the economy, opening of the economy. A very interesting case is Uruguay. As you know, in Uruguay, there is a very leftist government. President Mujica was a terrorist in his youth, and he spent many, many years in prison for putting bombs. You know, well, he won in free elections, power, and what is he doing in power? What is he doing, he and his comrades? Has destroyed democracy? Not one democratic institution has suffered with the Uruguayan government, has nationalized one enterprise, not one. And Uruguay has now probably the most encouraging kind of laws for attracting foreign investors. Entrepreneurs who were terrified with the victory of Mujica are so happy now with him. Argentine entrepreneurs are desperate to escape to Uruguay. We have, for the first time in our history, a leftist government which is democratic and which promote economic freedom. They have understood that there is only one model if you want to fight poverty, if you want to fight development. Well, this is what is happening in Uruguay. It is happening little by little everywhere in Latin America. And that is the reason why I think that what has happened to myself in these last 40 or 50 years is something that has been happening too in Latin America. Of course, history is not written. History is always in the making. And what will happen with history is not something that is produced as Marxists believe, because there are certain laws, like physical laws, that push countries in some direction or another. No, this is something human. This is something that result of behavior or of the electorate, of the common citizens. And it is because common citizens, the electorate, the political parties, have been adopting, sometimes with enthusiasm, sometimes with resignation, this idea that if you want really to become modern, if you want really to create a civilized society in which violence has been reduced to the minimum, the only way is accepting democratic culture, improving tolerance, and opening freedom in all the levels of society. This has been happening, and this is probably the reason why it is possible now to be optimistic about the future of Latin America. Of course, this is something that is still uncertain. We must act if we think that what is happening is important for all of us. All of us should, in one way or another, try to push Latin America in that direction. But at least now we know that this is possible, that Latin America is not condemned to be always underdeveloped, brutal kind of region in which injustices prevail over justice, and this magical world, liberal, has started to take roots in Latin America. Let's hope that for always. Thank you very much for your patience.